Hot Rise just released their 40th anniversary Bash live CD. We're going to talk to Pete Wernick, part one of my visit with Pete Wernick, as we talk about not just the 40th anniversary Bash CD, which is a wonderful thing to discuss. I've known Pete for a long time, and we talk about many things related to Pete Wernick and banjo. That's why we had to make it a two-parter. You'll enjoy it. I'm really happy to welcome back to Unreal Bluegrass one of my favorite bluegrass people, one of my all-time favorite banjo people, one of my guideposts as I go through this journey through bluegrass music, Dr. Banjo himself, Pete Wernick. How are you, Pete?
I'm doing real well, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine, doing fine. Listen, I'm always happy to chat with you about whatever. Today we have a kind of a specific topic to spin off on is this great 40th anniversary Bash from the Hot Rise Band.
Yes, it's an album with 19 music cuts on it because it was hard to kick any of them off. And it's really a very special thing for us. This is the first time we've had more than one guest on anything, and in fact, we've only had one guest on four cuts that we put out as a Hot Rise record. Back in the 80s, we had Jerry Douglas play four cuts on one of our records. And other than that, every Hot Rise record has only four people on it. But now we have seven.
Well,
and that's cool and different.
And Jerry Douglas is one of the guests on this new anniversary.
He's one of them. And then Stuart Duncan, my idea of the best fiddler in bluegrass.
Yeah.
And then Sam Bush, no slouch.
No.
Those three guys pretty much changed bluegrass music and Sam in the 70s, and then Stuart became well-known in the 80s, and they really changed the face of bluegrass, bringing a huge level of virtuosity to the music. And also, all three of them are real nice guys who are easy to get along with and know how to fit in a whole variety of situations. They all fit in a lot with a lot of other people. So getting them all together with us was sort of like the dream team, you might say. And speaking for myself, I'm just floored by being on stage with six other people of that caliber. It's just amazing.
I think they would probably look around and say the same thing with you downstage from them.
Well, you're awfully nice, Steve. On the technical level, I don't consider myself anywhere near the top of the bluegrass banjo heap, but I don't downgrade myself as a person who really knows how to play Hot Rise music on the banjo, and I've spent a lot of time working on that and, probably played about 2,000 shows with Hot Rise. So a lot of it has had a time to ripen up and be meaningful for me to contribute, because I'm really proud of our material. Hot Rise is very fussy about what we want to perform, and so when we pick a good piece to perform, I really want to make every part of what I do on the banjo really complimentary and just help bring out the essence of the song. So I try to play the melody a lot. And when I play backup, I'm aware of the context and try to do the right thing, whatever that might be.
Yeah, and you do it so well, and I do think that we could talk forever about that difference between the melody and then blending in and being in support. But in my opinion, you do that as well as anyone because you learned it and studied it.
Well, I used to be a DJ myself, as you probably know.
I do remember, yeah.
And I also did some books that involved interviews. So I recently checked it out and found that I've done 77 recorded interviews with famous bluegrass performers starting in 1964 when I was in my teens, but I was already a DJ.
Well, there were interviews for Masters of the Five-String Banjo. Were those recorded in
that? Yeah, I recorded those.
Yeah, okay.
I have some really good ones with Bill Monroe.
Oh, nice.
After a real bad false start with him over the phone, where he refused to answer any of my questions and just got me completely frazzled over that. But then three other times he gave me really good interviews that really helped me understand a lot about bluegrass. And so I'm still of the generation, you might say, where I had full exposure to the people who created bluegrass. I got to see, you know, many bands with Monroe starting in 1962. I saw Flat and Scruggs in 61, and the Carnegie Hall concert was the third time I saw him.
Were you, and, you, then you I got were at to, Carnegie Hall? Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I was 16, and anybody who was into bluegrass that year absolutely had to be at Carnegie Hall, and I was. So, and so were a bunch of my friends. In fact, I even can hear, recognize the voices of the people in the crowd who called out for Martha White repeatedly. I can hear who's yelling what because I recognize their voices on the recording because they were like in the front row.
Of all the time that I've known you, Pete, I did not know you were there. I should have guessed it, but...
Well, I never thought it was that big a deal because I just went to see him any time they came to town, and that was my third time seeing him, and I saw them other times besides. In fact, a lot of people don't know they played Carnegie Hall again about a year later, and I went to that too. It didn't get a record made out of it, and it was not historic in the same way the first one was, but... but anyway, I got all this exposure to the different bluegrass people, and in fact, I got a lot of wisdom from the important people in bluegrass, you know, the people who created bluegrass. Usually you get wisdom if you join their band, and I even tried to join, you know, I offered myself to Bill Monroe without any success, but and not even in person. I wrote him a letter. That's how naive I was at the time that I thought that. That's how you applied. And I said, I'll come to Nashville if you need me to, but I should have just gone to Nashville and showed up at his door and say, I want to be in your band. That's kind of how they do it. But I was naive at the time, and I went from being extremely naive to a lot more comfortable with all these guys and have spent time with them. And the reason I got on talking about that is my, you know, I certainly found out how important playing the melody is. Talking with Jimmy Martin, he'll harangue you about that for a while. J.D. Crow would harangue you about that for a while. So would Earl Scruggs, and so would Bill Monroe. So when I teach, and I just taught out here recently out in Colorado at the Rocky Grass Academy, I made sure all of my students, and I had advanced in part of the time, intermediate and basic part of the time, and even with the advanced people, a lot of them are not too keen on finding the melody by ear. And I said, guys and gals, if you're going to be a good bluegrass musician, you have to be able to have the ear skills to find the melody almost immediately, just like you can sing back a melody. If you can't play it back on your instrument, you're losing this foundational part of any solo you ever play. So when I play solos, I take the trouble to include a lot of the melody. That's what Earl always did. And then embellish it in your own style, of course, so that people don't hear just the same out of every banjo player. You know, to me, that's a big part of bluegrass musicianship that has made bluegrass love. The bluegrass fans love the music, and, you know, there's a lot of amazing, truly amazing and really talented players out there, and only a few of them really make a point of playing the melody very much, and a lot of times you listen to them and you don't even know what song is going on unless you know, you heard the singing, and even some of the bands, their singing is not very clear. I've heard some really talented bands where I can't understand the words. And it's not just because my ears are 72 years old. I got checked out recently, and the person said, your hearing is quite good. So, you know, and I never had any trouble understanding, you know, whatever, Bill Monroe or Lester Flatt or Elvis or the Beatles. So why should I have a hard time understanding a new bluegrass band that's trying to get on the map? So, you know, I'm a born teacher, you might say. My dad was had two different teaching jobs, a high school math chairman and also taught math in college, and so I've been teaching since I was 18, and it really matters to me that bluegrass is carried on in the best possible way, which doesn't mean any particular style of bluegrass. It just means if you're going to have a band, let's hear the melody, let's hear the words. that shouldn't be too hard, but some bands don't seem to notice that, unfortunately.
And Pete, I'm talking to Pete Warnick, if people are just tuning in, and that's one of the things that I know about Pete very well, is not only does he give formal lessons, and he has the Warnick method, and he has banjo classes, you're always teaching. If you see a young band and you catch them off stage, I've seen you do this, you give them very positive reinforcement about things to do, and they listen to you because they know that you've been there. And I've seen it happen many times where you're just always teaching. You're always passing along wisdom.
To me, some people might consider it meddlesome, and I sometimes actually walk up to a band that I don't even know, but they know who I am, and I say, you didn't ask for this suggestion, but I really care about bluegrass, and I want your band to succeed, so I'm going to give you some suggestions if you don't mind. And they say, oh, yeah, let's hear. And a lot of times it is, you try to make sure the audience gets what you're doing. It's not, don't just play for the musicians, play for or the people who already know the song.
Right.
You know, you have to, if you watch Flatt & Scruggs videos, which I still do quite frequently, they were selling bluegrass to an audience that, by that time, the audience already knew them and loved them, but they wouldn't have loved them if they couldn't have understood the words or the melody was too obscure. And Earl, in his book, talks about stuff like that. And like I said, from all the 77 interviews that I did with everybody, you know, I even interviewed Ralph and Carter Stanley, believe it or not, in 1965 at the first Bluegrass Festival. And I just picked up a lot of that stuff without having to actually travel with them and as a band member. And I'm not saying it's the same, but I, considering I didn't get to stand up next to these people and play with them on stage. I did get to play with Scruggs on stage, and I did get to play with Monroe on stage a number of times. So, but it's different when you're in the band, and that's a real education. And but I got this other kind of education, and have and I really want to communicate it. The old guys from bluegrass who started it, they're almost all gone now, and somebody has to carry on the trunk of the tree part, not just the branches. You know, Del McCurry is now absolutely the guiding light for people who love bluegrass. His band and he personally, he's got it together in a big way, and that's what I refer people to if they want to know what real bluegrass is. There it is. Every day they go out and play, they're writing down, or they're performing, you know, what bluegrass is all about, in my opinion.
You're right. Pete, I'm always happy to chat with you about anything. The 40th anniversary bash, and I could let this go on forever.
Let's talk about the album.
Let's
promo time.
it's a special album. There are the only song that I really, and I think you make a point of mentioning this, is Wichita Lineman. I've not heard you do that before. And that's added. It's all live. It's taken from several nights at the Boulder Theater, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And Wichita Lineman, I think, was a thrower for me. I think most of these tunes I could trace back as to why I know what they were and where they came from in Hot Rise.
Well, Wichita Lineman is on the solo record I made in 1977. How could you possibly have missed
that?
It's only 41 years ago.
I have that.
And we recorded it with just Tim singing and playing fiddle. And I guess he overdubbed fiddle and played mandolin, and there's a bass and me. There's no guitar on that cut, but I added synthesizer because I was feeling experimental at the very end of the cut to sort of a nod to the sound of electricity going through a line or something. I don't know. But I always thought that was the greatest song. It's such a great song. The melody is so interesting and different because it actually changes keys back and forth in the space of one verse, which you don't even notice but until you try to figure it out. And Glenn Campbell sang it so amazingly well. And the words, there's not a lot of words in that song, but it paints a very full picture, including the part that really touches the heart, and I need you more than want you kind of thing. And I want you for all time. Oh, man, what lyrics. I'm getting chills even thinking about it, because the guy is a high, lonesome guy. He goes up on top of telephone poles all day long. So he's high and he's lonesome. That's bluegrass. So I turned that number into a bluegrass number with my banjo arrangement. And then Tim Right from the very beginning of the band, we were doing that cut, but we have kind of let it drift away, and then it came back for this album, and so did a tune that we used to play early on that we never recorded either, which is called Huckling the Berries.
That was going to be my next country cooking record. That's right. Yeah, it was country cooking.
Yeah, that was one we used to we only had a few original songs or tunes at the beginning of Hot Rise, so we made a point to feature them, and I was the only person who had produced an original at the time the band started. Within the first year, though, Tim wrote Nellie Kane, which was, I immediately noticed, holy crap, that's going to be a classic.
It is.
And it is. And a lot of people do it, and it's done at jam sessions, and people ask me, how do I play the break on it? And it's actually the easiest break I play. It's really easy, except it's using the somewhat unfamiliar key of D for most people. We do it in E, but I play it as though it's in D on the banjo, and a lot of banjo players think of that as China, a foreign country where best avoided. But a lot of Hot Rise music uses that configuration, so
Pete
helps us sound different.
Just to prove you, although I forgot Wichita Lineman was out there on record, I have the album you were talking about, On a Roll.
Uh-huh. The first solo album was from 77, and it's called Dr. Banjo Steps Out. It was on Flying Fish, and now it's on Concord. On a Roll was made in 1992 and 3, and it came out in 93. And that was my second solo album with quite a variety of both of them have quite a variety of experimental stuff as well as
speaking of experimental stuff, I also have Flexigrass, Pete Wernick and Flexigrass.
Yeah, well, the debut of Flexigrass was on the On a Roll album, which is now about 25 years old. And Flexigrass has a gig in a few days, by the way.
Good.
So I'm glad. And we're also playing at Merlefest, we just found out. Merlefest. We'll have the whole band there. And I'm glad to have this kind of oddball concoction as part of my musical offering, as well as the mostly straight bluegrass of Hot Rise. And I also sometimes play with a band called Long Road Home here in Colorado that's real straight bluegrass, with a good singer and all kinds of good musicians in it, that, including the national mandolin champion from Winfield of a couple of years ago. And we have some records, too. If you don't have Long Road Home records, I should get those to you.
I will find it. I'll find it. Pete, I keep taking you down, because I haven't talked to you in forever, it seems like. So I keep taking these little eddies away from the Hot Rise anniversary, 40th anniversary Bash album. And I want to come back to that, but there's so many things. Every time I talk to you, I wind up on something else of my own choice. And you're always gracious enough to fill in. So I'm just like...
Two ADD guys talking together. Watch out.
That could be. That could.
What'd you have for lunch 4 days ago? Let's ride bikes.
Yeah, there you go. There's something shiny over there. I know the problem. But Hot Rise to me, and this album, it's a good recording. You want to do that. It's going to be available on, by the time this airs, it will have been released, I guess, for the street, as they say, although I don't know where the street is anymore, August 3rd. And you're going to have a vinyl version that comes out also.
Yeah, the vinyl version will be out in the month of August, and it's already out on the Hot Rise website, which, believe it or not, is hotrise.com. Don't forget, it's a Z in Rise. Anyway, whatever you'd like to know about that, yeah, we had a good recording. Nick, by dint of doing the E-Town radio program, which is now in its, I believe, 28th year, he's got a tremendous crew, and that's why we have amazing videos coming out now. We already have 3 out that are live videos of the show.
Oh, great.
Really well edited, well lit. So the production values are really high, thanks to a very experienced E-Town staff that got it all down, and it was recorded really well. And I don't know, it's just as high quality as we can make it.
Do you think, Pete, down the road, that since you have these videos that are coming out, you think there might ever be a DVD that might come out following?
We hope so. Actually, it's going to be shopped to somebody who does that kind of thing.
Okay.
And a lot of material. In fact, they did a lot of interviews. We have also a great Steve Martin recorded a wonderful tribute and a secret chord that he demonstrates And we, so far we haven't used it yet, but if there's a long form video, it'll go on there, I'm sure. And
you haven't used the secret cord or the video?
Not the cord, but no. Steve demonstrating okay. the secret cord and congratulating us. And,
okay.
and even right now, they're still trying to book some gigs for us at the end of this year while the record is still fresh, and we have some open dates in November and December that they're trying to fill. So we're hoping all, you know, the music gets around and people get enough interested that they want to see us. And that's in the works as well. So, you know, the machine is still rolling along.
Well,
no one knows how long, but we are rolling.
I last saw you at Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival. I did not have the opportunity to catch you. I mean, I saw mm-hmm. you, but I didn't get a chance to say, hey, Pete, I'm over here or anything like that. That's why I thought we could catch up a little bit later. But fantastic
Absolutely.
Show. You got, and I keep thinking about this, too. Number one, you're a good band. You've been doing this a long time. And when you're on stage, there's that instant comfortable feel. I know as a performer you have to be a little bit on edge or it's not real. But
yeah.
you guys are so good at a live presentation. Hot Rise is one of the better. And you have so many great, I mean, Nick and Tim and everything that contributes to this sound is just, you're good at this.
Well, thank you for the compliments. No musician wants to turn down a compliment, but I could, you know, one of the things that I've always believed in is that if a band stays together for a while, the dividends start coming in sometimes years and years later. And just being on stage a lot, oh, I don't know, like we have the one DVD that we did put out, and it's also available from HotRise.com. It's a 1987 concert that we did for the Lonesome Pine Special, which was a TV show at the
yeah.
time. It was really a well-shot program with five cameras. And, of course, this is from 1987, so Charles Sautel is the guitar player.
That's right.
And it's a good record of what we sounded like back then. But on the very first song, Tim breaks his mandolin string, and he just kind of looks at me. You can see this on the video. This is on the first song of the video. And I just improvised the break, and it was kind of routine. And then when Ren Duckles and the Trailblazers come out, you know, sort of a bunch of mayhem starts, and a lot of times that is spontaneous and takes a certain amount of nerve to just say, I don't care if this is unrehearsed, I'm doing it.
And for the audience, I know, because I've seen them so many times, but explain to the audience, who are the Red Knuckles in the Trail? Who are these?
Well, Red people? Knuckles is the band leader, and the Trailblazers are all guys that live in Wyoming, Montana, a little border town. And we used to play their kind of music as part of our show when we first started. But it was a little silly watching me try to play the lap steel guitar mm-hmm. and, you know, Nick trying to play the electric guitar. So we realized it would be better if we just left the stage and had them come out instead. And they look entirely different from us.
They
are a different band.
They're absolutely different.
And they get a little stuck on themselves sometimes. So various comedy things happen. Then when we come back as, you know, being Hot Rise, it sort of pulls the show back together again, back to the professional level. But a lot of people like the music of the Trailblazers, which mm-hmm. is kind of the old country honky-tonk sound of like Hank Williams and Bob Wills from the old days.
And with a little bit of a twist.
With a twist, but in general, the music is really well reproduced faithfully, and Red Knuckles is a good singer. He has a lower range than Tim does. But some people say they sound similar.
I don't hear it.
And I don't know. But the instrumentation is entirely different, and they have very different personalities than Hot Rise. So it's nice having a band that travels with you that can take over the stage for a while, give you a rest, and come back fresh. And that's the way our shows tend to work in most cases. Although sometimes we just don't really want Red Knuckles around, so we like, you know, on the record, they're not on the record, even though they did participate in the 40th Bash concerts. But we didn't want them messing up our record, so they're not on the record, except on the vinyl, there's a picture of them playing, but we didn't want anybody to hear what they actually sounded like.